Hi, this is Paul, and this is the Bridges of Meaning Discord question and answer session of August 7, 2020. Pretty much every Friday, I'm here in the Bridges of Meaning Discord. You can find the link to it in the notes below, where I answer questions that come from listeners of my video and people that are in the Discord, and it's sort of ask me anything type questioning. I won't necessarily answer everything. But I'll answer what I can and what I should. So, yeah, let's get started. And Joe has a question before we get to the posted question. So go ahead, Joe.
Thank you, Paul. So as I was mentioning earlier, I have a close friend I've known since I was 16. And so we're like, tight as thieves, and have always been on similar sheets of music, so to speak. And now, 30 years down the road, in the last 6 to 8 months, first of all, in terms of our relationship, it's largely unfolds within a kind of a pop culture, secular humanist frame. He's maybe two generations removed from any practicing faith tradition. And I'm nominally Catholic, so that's the world where we convene or converge in the secular frame. And so within that frame, I suddenly find he is considers himself a man of science, so to speak, and is pretty confident that we're putting too much pressure on the environment, and it's just a matter of time before, we have an environmental breakdown. So there's an apocalyptic sense of around resource distribution and resource management, and our inability to, to get on top of that is going to be our demise and cause an enormous amount of pain and unnecessary pain and suffering. And so there's the Green New Deal, and he's very much a part of that and very much, increasingly progressive. And I found, I guess my point is that the way I'm grasping the situation is as if, okay, well, if that is the case, then by all means, it seems like anybody and everybody who isn't first and foremost addressing the threats to the planet, the ecosystem, are off base, or their priorities are askew. So Christians, non-Christians, all men and good men and women should direct their energies there. So anyway, I'm again, this isn't a question so much as a desire for context, because I don't know if indeed that's the case or not the case, that we're 14 years or 50 years or 1,000 years from catastrophe. But if that's the pivot point, it seems as though it's setting up a situation where that question has to be necessarily be answered or nuanced. And if it's not, we're, increasingly talking past each other. And so my question to you is that the question? And if it's not, how else would one situate or prioritize the main priority, the main issue? Does that make sense at all?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. Well, it's part of what's nice about doing question and answer like this is, even though maybe we haven't randomized according to some of the randomizing proposals that are being discussed right now, there is a certain randomness in this, and there is a certain sampling of the culture and the communities we live in from these questions coming up from you. Now, obviously, this sentiment is by no means unique to your friend, and it is very common right now out there in the zeitgeist, and it is an area of controversy and battle, and so it's worth discussing. One of the interesting things that is almost never pointed out in these discussions is just how much implicit humanism is beneath the, let's call it the green panic. Because there is, the, I mean, even the framing of this entire, let's call it, cultural anxiety, concern, or fear, I don't want to say that pejoratively, is the value that human lives and a degree of freedom and latitude for self-expression is something of value and ought to be preserved. You know, even Brett Weinstein's apocalyptic campaign has this belief beneath it. And if someone were a thoroughgoing green to the degree that humanity is a virus that plagues upon the earth, then environmental collapse could perhaps be the most welcome apocalypse imaginable, because the environment will collapse, humanity and its reign over this planet will come to an end, and undoubtedly elements of the world, such as, let's say, in Chernobyl, although marred perhaps by radiation and other pollutants we have left behind us, will once again take over the planet. As in the words of the movie The Matrix, humanity will be eliminated, and somehow this romantic notion of life without us will go on. Again, even in that life without us vision, there is an implicit monarchical vision, because the view of life without us that is promoted in such a vision is a human vision. Because, in a way, there's no seeing the world. We can imagine no seeing the world apart from somehow using human imagination to see the world through whatever other vision we imagine to see the world through. So, to at least at the beginning of this question, sidestep the question of whether or not such an apocalypse is true, this apocalypse, this anxiety is a deeply human one, and in some ways, and in some ways, a fruit of Christianity and a fruit of the Bible, because right there in the beginning of the Bible, we are called by God to steward the garden of his temple, which in many ways is what the earth is, according to the vision of Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. So, despite all of the intramural back-and-forthing over, the political back-and-forthing over Green New Deal, as with just about every other religious movement we find in our midst, these are all the children of Christianity. Now, whether they be rebellious children or obedient children, that's another question. But they are yet its children. And so even this very vision that humanity in its avarice and stupidity is threatening the natural systems upon which the liberty and enjoyment we currently possess are dependent, and we ought to do something to address this, that's a fruit of Christianity. Now, also revealed as a fruit of Christianity is the apocalyptic frame itself. Apocalypse, as I've spoken of regularly, is a, we bring, we gather that word from the book of Revelation. In Greek, apocalypse is simply a revelation. Well, what is being revealed? In the book of Revelation, Jesus Christ is being revealed. And Jesus Christ is being revealed to a world and an empire that has been standing against it. And that empire is often a city, or and that empire has a harlot that sits astride a beast. And, you know, all of this symbolic and imaginative framing, well, the deep framing is, in fact, of a vision that a glorious life, the likes of which we just sort of participate in now, a glorious life will, in fact, dawn. And so apocalypse, as the day of the Lord is almost always sort of a two-faced coin, where there's the face of destruction and there's the face of a new beginning. And many Christian words that deal, that trade in this idea, have that dimension. Consummation is another common one you'll hear me say. Consummation sounds like something being consumed by fire, and consummation at the same time is the beginning of something. And symbolically, these images also go all the way back to the Hebrew scriptures. And think about back when I was going through the book of Leviticus, I was reading through that book and studying that book, and I was just amazed at how much I didn't know before reading that book. And with almost every revelation of how much I didn't know, I am shocked and horrified and discouraged by the fact that I can see further vistas that not only don't I know now, but I probably don't have time in my little life to know. And so one of the ideas that you find built right there into the burning bush, this bush that is not consumed, is in many ways the same vision that is played out in the altar of the tabernacle and eventually the temple, where fire, the Lord says of himself, I am a consuming fire. Now, you can find parallel images of this in other world religions, where God is both life giver and life destroyer, and people talk about those things. And so, again, this vision is one of alarm, and I think it's a very secular alarm, because part of the deep assumption or presumption beneath modern humanism and secular humanism or godless humanism is that there is no benevolent agency above or beyond ourselves, and therefore it's simply up to us to save the planet. If I believed that were the case, I would be indeed depressed, because when you look at humanity's administration of the planet, for the most part, it's all of our imagined welfares that have brought us to the brink of this environmental collapse. So, well, maybe we'll, at this late stage, see the light and take some corrective action. And in many ways, I'm a moderate on these issues, because it isn't inconceivable to me that we are, in fact, destroying the planet. We've destroyed plenty of little chunks of it on our own. I grew up near the Passaic River. The Passaic River is a beautiful river, beautiful little river with one of the most majestic waterfalls on the North American continent. But if you stand by those, which we'd visit there rather regularly as a child, and you'd sit and the spray of that waterfalls would just cover you. And after being sprayed in that, you would imagine I should either go home and take a shower and or get some blood work, because who knows how many dioxins and other things have infiltrated my body through the spray of the Passaic River. And every winter when we'd get a freeze, the waterfalls would be glorious with ice, and the ice would all be this faint yellow because the water was so darn dirty. So we should realize our capacity to destroy our own environment. That doesn't seem to be unreasonable to think of, and to think that this, in fact, would scale up, that doesn't seem unreasonable. And it's often the case that God does not bail us out of the consequences of our own rebellion and sinful, corrupt nature and how we manage this planet. So it doesn't seem inconceivable to me that the Lord would just as much allow environmental collapse as he allowed moral collapse in how many different wars and genocides throughout the world. So it doesn't seem to me that God will necessarily simply intervene because we as children in the sandbox have made a mess of things. But in fact, we have on good authority of the Bible the belief that God in fact does intervene, and the only problem is he might not intervene in the way that we want him to. And so I think it is reasonable agency to have concern for the environment and to look at the various ways that we are making this world unbalanced. For all the discussion I hear about CO2, Brett Weinstein's the only one that I ever hear talking about, you know, the corruption of the nitrogen cycle, which was done by the Haber-Bosch process developed. And it's a terrific book on that called The Alchemy of Air that I very much recommend. But, you know, here's questions of us ruining the balance of CO2, questions of us ruining the nitrogen cycle. We've destroyed estuaries. We've done all sorts of things. God seems perfectly willing to let us play in the sandbox and to live in our mess for a while. He certainly does that in our individual lives. Why wouldn't he do that in the environment? So for us to do what we can to resolve it, but yet also remembering that if you do any reading at all in questions of the Green New Deal, there is a lot of evidence that the normal corrupting political influences are well at play in there. And you hear that in questions about nuclear or not nuclear, whether, you know, all of these good ideas can actually fix the world. So on one hand, I believe we should express our human agency in ways that cares for the planet and tries to help civilization go on into the future. Absolutely. On the other hand, let's not be so full of ourselves to think that, you know, we necessarily know everything that's going on. Let's take reasonable steps. Let's do it in a balanced approach. And I think in many ways, the COVID pandemic is a lesson in that because, you know, for a while, well, it's all about the environment. Now it's all about COVID. And then it's all about Trump. And if Trump loses the election, it'll be all about Biden's mental health. And then it'll be all about something else. Well, that all aboutness is simply a function of human consciousness that we can sort of only keep one thing on our mind at a time. And the way human consciousness scales up in principalities and communities around us, well, one thing seems to drive it, and somehow the United States government struggles to walk and chew gum at the same time. So this is all part of that big picture, too. So I'd say maintain your friendship with your friend. Don't begrudge him his anxiety. Hopefully your increasingly non-nominal religious Christian faith will help you afford him perhaps a little bit of your faith that, in fact, there are wiser, more powerful stewards of our existence than just ourselves and our politics. And in many ways, the imbalance of politics and religion is partially caused by secularity because, you know, we don't believe that there is a God. We don't believe that there is a steward. We don't believe that we are, in fact, in some sort of sandbox. Whether the sandbox is our consciousness or our human brain, secularity always shrinks the vision. So stay friends with your friend and be there when the imaginations and the schemes that he is resting his hope on to fix this world disappoint him, which they inevitably will. And I would suggest point him to a God who sees and cares and loves and one that he can put faith in. So that's my answer to the green panic.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Hey, I've got a question here if you're ready, Paul.
Sure, go for it. You sound good, too. I don't know what you did, but you sound, it's nice and clear.
Oh, I'm subbing in for the Scottish guy.
Oh, okay. I didn't. I wasn't looking there.
That's all right. This question is from KG Guy. He's got a question about a friend of the family who may or may not. I don't think he goes to church, but his question is: how do you spread your grace that you get from Christ to these other people? Okay, I'm going to go through the question now.
Yep.
The question is, a friend of the family, his name is Paul McCartney, who is not the famous Paul McCartney, and his daughter is married to this anti-theist Paul McCartney is married to a Christian girl who is extremely Christian, but he's thinking about this, and he's thinking about some of the prayers you've given, and then he remembers a quote from maybe another pastor or a quote from the Bible. Maybe you can place this quote. I'll read it. For the unbelieving husband has been sanctified because of his wife, and the unbelieving wife has been sanctified because of her husband. Then the old adage, you can't get into heaven on your daddy's coattails. Probably wasn't for the Bible. So his question is this kind of logic where the faith of the spouse is the salvation for the unbeliever's spouse? Is that supported by the Bible? That's his question.
Well, if you take a fairly evangelical view, or let's say American evangelical view, because I get myself in trouble by using words, but I have nothing else to use but words, so... What do we mean by saved? I would imagine that anti-theist who marries devoted Christian woman, she is saving him a little bit every day, probably saving him from himself and his anti-theism. And the evangelical. How accurately I'm using that word. The evangelical habit of defining salvation as blessed inclusion at the banquet of the Lamb is not a bad one. It's a terrific way in many ways to shorthand what we probably can't fully conceive of or appreciate. Okay? And that salvation that is won for us by Christ is something that certainly is well depicted in all of the visions of inclusion in this wedding banquet, the feast of the patriarchs, participation in reigning over the new earth with a united new heavens and new earth, the all things having been made new by Christ that he declares in the book of Revelation. That's not a bad shorthand account of the salvation that is won for us. Surely you'll be with me today in paradise, Jesus says to the revolutionary on the cross. Those are good things. Now, but the salvation that Jesus wins for us isn't simply outsourced to that other world. That is clear in Jesus' parables. That is clear in the writings of the New Testament. And I think it is implicit in the Old Testament that, and I think the book of Hebrews helps us with that. Because when Isaac was born of Abraham and Sarah, that was a little sacramental realization of the breadth of salvation that Abraham could not imagine. All right? And so in that way, the birth of Isaac was a little bit of salvation that God afforded. And the whole story is set up that this is so clearly something that Abraham and Sarah are unable to achieve on their own. Did they have sex? Is it a virgin birth? No. But they are far beyond the years, and Sarah laughs, because here the joy of youth that we hardly recognize when we have it, will be revisited upon them in old age. There is a tiny little sample of the salvation that is wrought by Christ for them, wrought by the seed of Abraham and Sarah's own loins. So, what does that mean with respect to the anti-theist husband with a famous name and his believing wife? She, every day, I would assume, brings little tastes of that salvation into his life. And if that were not the case, he likely would divorce her. And so what exactly was, I haven't, you know, in these question and answers, I can't really pull up the verse and do a big dissection, but so I'll have to work off the top of my head. Is Paul suggesting that somehow this believing wife will pull anti-theist Paul McCartney through the gates of heaven? That's more than I can know. I will leave that to Christ and his ministration of inclusion and exclusion in the life of the age to come. And I leave that to him, partly out of obedience to judge not that you be not judged. It is not our place to mete out condemnation and condemnation and salvation on others. God alone has that. But it is the place that we can, in at times, offer assurance to some, and maybe not be able to offer such assurance to others, because we are not left without knowledge by the scriptures of this, but we do not have this knowledge completely. Just like we don't have the knowledge of what salvation will be completely. So, whatever specifically Paul of Tarsus had in mind when he was using that phrase, theologically, my answer to this, and some might take offense at this, but my answer to this is in some ways the answer I give to people who ask me if their pets will be in heaven. Now, I do some rough translating in my head. When they say heaven, I think they're thinking, well, the life of the age to come, that's in some semblance begins at our death. But even that question, you know, there's plenty of debate over intermediate state, these kinds of things. We're with the Lord, and then the various stages of what comes next. You know, we know so little of the life of the age to come. What we're told is told for our benefit, is told for our hope, is told for our strengthening and our encouragement. And so let's use it for those things and try not to. I don't think it's necessarily sinful to speculate, but let's think about it. And so, will the faith of this woman pull her heel-dragging husband, you know, past Peter's watchful eye? I don't know, but God, I have to be careful here, because part of Protestantism is resistant to speculations of purgatory, but purgatory, I can understand why purgatory and its teachings arose. The Protestant reformers didn't really want this being taught in the church because it wasn't in Scripture, and I think that's fair. At the same time, J.R.R. Tolkien in Leaf by Niggle has a very interesting passage of Niggle's passage through Purgatory. And I don't want to undermine Protestantism's and Christianity's insistence that there's an ultimate element to the decisions we make in this life. God, in many ways, affords our willful decisions with ultimate seriousness. And I don't believe there's anything in Calvinism that takes away from this. That God honors our choices. And so if a determined anti-theist decides that he really doesn't want the imposition of a God who made the world and yet lays claim to it today, you know, in the words of C.S. Lewis, God says, well, you've never wanted me before. I'm not going to impose myself on you at the far higher volumes that the banquet of the Lamb supposes. I think that's fair. And God, in that sense, honors our wishes to be rid of him. Okay. So, at the same time, how will this play out? What we know, in all likelihood, of the relationship between Paul McCartney and his believing wife is that their story is not yet done. And if a thief on a cross, a revolutionary on a cross, can begin his tortured last day mocking Jesus and end it by seeing the revelation of the Son of Man splayed for the world's mockery and have a change of heart and the Son of Man receive him into his kingdom that day, hey, who am I to say that won't happen? At the same time, what happened to the other thief? Jesus doesn't tell us. And so I don't think it's a betrayal of the scriptures to leave that silence silent. And this is why, in many ways, to venture into the universalist debate that I don't know if it's still raging on Bridges of Meaning, I won't be a universalist because I'm a Protestant, and I don't find in the scriptures the warrant to presume that all will one day be reconciled. I don't know that much. If in fact that is God's plan that he has not chosen to reveal to us through the scriptures, well, he'll reveal it to me when he's good and ready. And I'll live satisfied until that point with understanding that one revolutionary on the cross is welcomed that day into God's paradise, and Jesus says nothing of the second. And so, was the second saved by the other? Jesus didn't give us any indication of that. Paul gives us a little tantalizing vision that perhaps Paul McCartney is not bereft of revelation by the virtue of his believing wife. And to what effect that will have on the destination of Paul McCartney's next chapter, the signs are hopeful. But beyond that, what do we know? So there's my answer, KG.
Yeah, thank you. I have another question, if you're ready.
Yep.
This question is from Christian T. Golden, who's actually in chat right now. His question is about the book Brothers Karamazov. Are you familiar with that?
Yep.
Well, he's finished reading the book. Christian T. Golden has finished reading the book, and he thinks he's found a theory about the modern, I guess, woke politics. He thinks he found a theory about modern woke politics in the actual book, and it's a quote from the pastor in the book. The pastor is
Father Zosima. Yep.
Oh, maybe you could explain just for my benefit, who is Father Zosima?
Well, he's this, if I'm remembering correctly, it's been a few years. The book, so Aloysia is a young, you know, one of the three brothers, and he is the saintly brother, and he's a godly, innocent, childlike figure who really represents purity. And if I'm recalling correct, or Father Zosima is an old saint in the church that is sought after by people for his piety, for his for revelation. For many times, people want counsel. People want to hear God's word from him for them. And Aloysia is caring and loves this old father. So if I'm getting this wrong, feel free to correct me. So that's likely the context of this.
Yeah, well, the question is basically, it's a longer quote. It's about two paragraphs. And he thinks this speaks directly to woke politics. And I'll read it, if you're all right.
Yes, go ahead.
Father Zosima, above all, don't lie to yourself. The man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie comes to such a pass that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others. And having no respect, he ceases to love, and in order to occupy and distract himself without love, he gives way to passions and coarse pleasures, and sinks to bestiality in his vices, all from continual lying. To occupy and distract himself without love, he gives way... Oh, I already read that. The man who lies to himself can be more easily offended than anyone. You know, it is sometimes very pleasant to take offense, isn't it? A man may know that no one has insulted him, but that he has invented the insult for himself, has lied and exaggerated to make it picturesque, has caught it a world and made a mountain out of a molehill. He knows that himself, yet he will be the first to take offense, and he will revel in his resentment till he feels great pleasure in it, and so pass. And so pass to
genuine vindictiveness. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the question.
Yeah, and so then he continues. It struck me how this quote might get at something at the core of today's social justice virus. I wonder if the onset of one's falling ill with the social justice virus is deep, deliberate, or not. Lying to oneself. Is there anything in particular about this excerpt that you find reflects either some symptom or some cause of today's social woes? Well, this quote is common to humanity. And, you know, I think we ought to be patient and understanding. Many who parrot the language, the phrases, the call out there right now want good things. I mean, who of us is for racism? Who of us is for the abuse of the fairer sex? Who of us is, you know, for the marginalization of the weak? These are good things that this movement wants in many ways. Some of the means by which it thinks it will have it, well, that's another thing. When I read this, obviously in the context of the book, it's a reflection on the other brothers and some elements of them. You know, one of the brothers is an intelligent, sharp philosopher. The other is living his life in dissipation. And so in the Brothers Karamazov, you get this wonderful image of probably part of what Dostoevsky saw in himself, these three competing spirits within him that were vying for himself, the saint and the sophist and the lush. And so, you know, When I read this paragraph that you shared, I think about what Jordan Peterson says about, tell the truth or at least don't lie. Because the worst lie is to lie to yourself. And as Jordan Peterson often talked about, he had to stop lying because lying made him weak. Well, what kind of weakness does lying make you? Lying makes you weak to the future. Lying makes you weak to the truth. And so the man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie and believes in his own lie, comes to the point that he cannot distinguish the truth within him anymore. He loses his conscience and so loses all respect for himself and others. That's true. Now, you can see an element of this in some who are, I think I can very much understand where you see some of that spirit in the current social justice, progressive liberationist vision. That there is, but it's not just in that vision. In some ways, the spirit of this paragraph is manifest in the overall spirit of the age, because part of what has taken up residence in our communal dialogue is a greater spirit of offense. And you find conservatives playing this same game too, that, I'm offended, therefore I am, kind of a Cartesian possession of the spirit of offense. And, part of the reason psychologically people indulge in this is because psychologically and emotionally, righteous indignation is perhaps the only righteousness that their trap of falsehood can afford. And that's this isn't unique to our present age by any means. Why is it that in prison, not a place where you'll necessarily find a lot of social justice mythology perpetrated, why is it in prison that prisoners can find a degree of consolation in righteous indignation against the pedophile or whatever prisoner they decide is more worthy of their cell than they are? This is such a deeply human pattern that Dostoevsky points it out and so amazingly details it here for us. But this comes up again and again and again. It's a far deeper habit than our current political moment. So you can recognize it in the moment, but not necessarily defines that moment. Way more other things, some of them good and some of them bad, come into this moment.
Thank you. That's perfect.
Great quote, by the way. Thank you for the questions. Great question.
Yeah, actually, if I can just a moment.
Yeah, go ahead.
When I first read the quote, it was actually, I was reflecting on myself. I saw myself a lot in it.
Yeah.
Particularly when I look back on my teen and early 20s, there was that part of myself that would feel a certain way about something, but then intellectually I would know better, so to speak, and so I would stuff down what I actually believed in favor of what I thought I knew. And I would trick myself into thinking that I believed what I knew. It was very strange. And so what I see, and I thank you for pointing out that it's important to be patient with people who are maybe on the woke side of things. What I see is what I imagine is people feeling or believing one way, but mouthing something else because they think that's what they're supposed to actually believe. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of inspired me to write this as a question here and get your feedback. So thank you so much.
Well, yeah, thanks for bringing the quote in. You know, quotes like these are they're treasures and they're gifts to us. And so to be able to pull it into this forum and to have it, you know, shine again in this place is, serves us all. So thank you.
I've got another question if you're ready.
Yep.
This question is from Mirror 2. He's got a nice red avatar here. His question is about natural rights, like in the Bill of Rights. Do they only come from God, or is there a different source of these rights? And I'll read his question also. When discussing the Declaration of Independence, my U.S. history professor just this week said, people have tried to explain where we get our rights from. Is it something other from God? And none of these other theories or answers has ever proved to be credible or even acceptable or even useful. So we always end up back at God. And also Bishop Barron, he made a video on the topic as well. Is this something that's useful for evangelization, or should we talk about it more?
I think that's an excellent point. I haven't seen Bishop Barron's video on that. So let's say you're a skeptic or agnostic or atheist, and you are allergic to the concept that we get our rights from God. The professor made a real good point that where else are we going to get them from? And this is something that I, you know, as I wrestle with my own faith and belief in the midst of the secular age where we're at, I keep coming back down to that. And I saw this so clearly in Jordan Peterson's work, that when you, God set apart, you know, if I were talking to John Vervaeke, he would say something to the effect of, well, this doesn't prove the ontology of God. Well, fair enough. But it certainly demonstrates the usefulness of the ontology of the idea of God, that this idea has proven so enormously fruitful, so enormously beneficial, so enormously vital and apparently even indispensable for the world that we currently enjoy, that we eliminate this idea at our own peril. And I think the work of Jordan Peterson, my understanding of Jordan Peterson is that he basically comes to the point of saying, now, he's not ready publicly as a scientist, as a psychologist to assert the existence of God. He'll keep that private in kind of classical liberal fashion. But the idea of God seems so incredibly indispensable that we can't be rid of it. And if, in fact, we rid ourselves of the idea of God, we will very quickly lose for ourselves many ideas that are built on top of it. One of the most important ones being the idea of human rights. And, well, then you might ask, well, see, this is where God number one and God number two and those dynamics come in. Because, well, in many ways, why should human beings be afforded this privileged place in our community, in our planet? This gets back to the question about the Green New Day. If you're coming at the question of environmental collapse from the position of a humanist, well, guess what? In many ways, you're still back into this same realm that human rights are important, and we try to preserve the ecology for the sake of human rights. That tempers the pursuit of the salvation of the environment. You oughtn't to do it at the expense of human rights. And this is, in fact, many of the conundrums we see today in that pursuit. So I think the professor is very much right. And even if someone is skeptical about the idea of a God parting the skies and Jesus descending, as the angels said to the apostles that he would return in this same manner, well, okay, be skeptical. But the idea of God, I think this is exactly why, and this I think we've seen in the 20th century, it's at the heart of the work of Jordan Peterson. People like to dispense of the idea of God, usually because of implications of God number two in their life. But increasingly, like we saw with Sargon of Akkad, people are kind of warming back up to God number one because they realize, doggone it, if we lose that idea, we're going to lose a whole bunch of other ideas. And if these ideas are lost, they're no longer going to inhabit human beings. And that will point yet others to say, well, how do these ideas, you know, just in the way that there needs to be sort of a crowd herd immunity with COVID for us to go out safely. Well, there needs to be sort of a herd agreement with many of these ideas for these ideas to gain enough, to gain critical mass to support certain civilizations. Well, how are these ideas perpetuated from one generation to the next in humanity? Well, I'll tell you, it happens in Sunday school. It happens in churches. And this is why, as with many of the deists, Ben Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, who may not have been confirmed in a church and might have been skeptical about the particulars of Christianity, their deism kept them as supporters of the church because they said, if you don't, in that sense, have herd agreement on these ideas, then a whole bunch of the other ideas that colonize and shape human civilization are not going to be present. And if those ideas are not present, you're not going to get the kinds of outcomes we enjoy. In that sense, what they are doing is protecting the spiritual ecosystem, just as the Green New Deal people are trying to protect the biological ecosystem. Because what human beings are carriers of these ideas and expressions of these ideas. Ideas have people, remember. And we who are in many ways script runners, if these scripts become too few and far between in the population, suddenly you start losing things. And you start losing things that we have enjoyed for a while now, and things that we don't wish to lose. So, no, and that's why there are many out there who might be skeptical about the ontology of God, but continue to say, well, we need the idea of God to be out there in the population, because that idea of God in whose image we are made, well, suddenly we have the basis for humanism and the kinds of rights that people all over the world continue to flock to the free countries in the West for. And so, you know, in many ways, at least the political aspect of Jordan Peterson, there it is.
Yeah. Does anybody want to chime in? Okay, I have another question, if that's all right.
Yep.
This is from the Magic Dwagon, who's actually in chat right now. And he's been asking this question for 3 weeks in a row, so let's get to it. His question is about, he's writing stuff, and he really wants to have more clarity when he writes stuff. And it seems like everybody either understands him or wants to understand him. So he's looking for some practical advice, and I'll read the whole question. I have become sure it is impossible to prevent others from misinterpreting things I say or write. even when heard or read in good faith. I'm disappointed to conclude this, but I realize it's not practical to let my world depend on my perfection, even if I have to attain it in life or after death. So, to continue in practical, have you thought about being clear, or how to be clear, as a person, as a pastor, and an internet sensation? Thoughts on honesty and care also welcome, but clarity is the focus of this question. Thanks.
That's a great question. I'm glad you persevered through 3 weeks. You're right. It is impossible to prevent others from misinterpreting things that any of us say. To recognize... So, I've used this illustration before. There was a... I had a friend named Brandon who was an extraordinary guy. He grew up in a Christian Science church. And if you know anything about Christian Science, they avoid modern medicine. Brandon had childhood diabetes in a Christian Science church where they didn't use modern medicine. And so he went years of his childhood without insulin, and this obviously bore a heavy burden on his body, bore a heavy burden on his parents' marriage. His parents would break up. Brandon was a terrific musician. He covered his, eventually he, you know, got medical treatment for his diabetes and took insulin all his life. He covered his body in tattoos, which is kind of crazy if you knew his health situation. He lost most of his vision, but would insist on riding a bicycle blind, if you can think about that. He liked working with machine tools, which was an incredible thing with low vision. Towards the end of his life, he lost his hearing, which was an incredibly difficult thing for him. He was a member of many of the Christian Reformed churches in our little sacramental cluster at one time or another, and eventually landed here at Living Stones and lived right down the street from the church for a while. I had a room available here, and so I gave him an office. And at one time, he tried his hand at preaching. He passed away not very long ago. I knew he was dying. His wife was at work. The kids were at school. And Big Marker, he wrote DNR, do not resuscitate, on his body. And he barricaded himself in his room so no first responders would get to him in time. And he made a bunch of phone calls to me and to others a day or two prior to, I think he felt his death coming. And I was on vacation and didn't get his phone call. And then his father called me a few days later to let me know that he had died. Why am I telling you this story? He hung out with me at church quite a bit. And I got to know about the ups and downs of someone with very low vision to blindness. And I remember him explaining to me how he understood mentally that what he saw the world was sort of like looking through a paper towel roll tube. If you look through a roll tube, you see just this really constricted view of the world, which takes out all your peripheral vision. And it's that reason why I would sometimes walk up to him, and if I'm wearing a black shirt or something, he couldn't even see me. And so, bang, I would pop into his field of vision, and I would startle him all the time. And I always found that rather funny, and he found it rather annoying, but he forgave me, and I tried to stop doing it. But it was just a wonderful illustration of the limits of our perception. And so as Jordan Peterson talked to Roger Scruton in that one conversation, Peterson so aptly said, we walk around basically seeing cartoons, and these cartoons are as much a product of our own mental construction as they are of what's out there in the world. And this is illustrated by Brandon's vision, because in his mind, he saw the world just as I see it here. this panoramic vision that I think I'm seeing everything in the room, but actually this is an image that my brain is creating, and it's just filling in all the gaps. And that's why if I close my one eye, I don't see my blind spot. But there are tricks, of course, where you can recognize where your blind spot is, where the optic nerve reaches your retina. But when I close one eye, I don't see it because my brain is simply filling in the picture. Now, every time I communicate, you are hearing me at a resolution. And again, I'm indebted to Jordan Peterson for his high resolution, low resolution way of talking. You hear me at a fairly low resolution, and your salience hierarchies, and I'm indebted to John Vervaeke for some of this stuff. You are listening to me even as you're hearing every word I'm saying, even if in your short-term memory I can pause, and you just heard me say, even in your short-term memory, you are mentally registering each of those words by virtue of your... You are only going to remember selective things. You can't simply retake it all in. We know this from robots. We know this from video cameras. We know this, okay? This is really certain stuff, that we are bad listeners of each other. And everything I'm saying to you right now is being filtered through entire lifetimes of filtering. So we are patterns listening to patterns. And so you are absolutely right, and it is a mark of wisdom that it is impossible to prevent others from misinterpreting things you say, because the only things they are picking up on are the things that actually fit into their framework. And that's why all of our biases are, on one hand, such huge obstacles to understanding the world, but so abundantly necessary for us to be able to appropriate the world. So it is a mark of wisdom that you understand the limitations of your hearers. I'm disappointed to conclude that this, but realize it's not practical to let my world dependent on my perfection. Well, good luck on that perfection, my friend. and we'll see what our limitations are in our resurrected bodies. How have you thought about being clear as a person, Pastor? Internet sensation. Wow, I don't know if I should take that as a... I don't know how I should take the last thing. I'll take it charitably, because I think I'm sure that's the way it was given. Communication is hard. You know, and you can learn it from all sorts of people. I remember during the presidency of George W. Bush, I would get so annoyed at how much he would repeat himself on things. After I had to get over my own annoyance, I recognized it was actually a mark of a wisdom, because I learned in church that if you want people to hear you, repeat yourself. Repetition has its own liability, however, because we're hearing through this filter of salience hierarchies. Therefore, we're always judging chaos and order, or the mapped and unmapped territory. So even in repeating yourself, make sure you repeat yourself in a new way. So it has to have enough repetition so that it's familiar enough to be absorbed, but it can't have too much repetition so that it's boring. And this is why we so regularly talk about what does and doesn't interest me, and we turn towards which does, and we turn away from that which doesn't. And so often that which doesn't interest us because we have seen the pattern so often and often concluded that there's no useful things there. One of Jordan Peterson's little tidbits that he offered was the idea that the same place in our brain that looks for information is the exaptation, word I got from Vervaeke, that the exaptation, that the same machinery in our brain that looks for food looks for information. And that makes good sense, because for us as human being, getting food out of this world, because we are such omnivorous eaters, getting food out of this world is all about information. And my son and his girlfriend and their dog were in our yard for the last few days, and I was just watching that dog always returned to places. They had spilled some kibble, and it was amazing how many times that dog returned to that place where that food had spilled. So that dog is processing information and smell and all of those things. So basically your question is, how can I be a more effective colonizer of the world with my ideas? Well, you keep working at it. You keep learning. You keep watching people. You keep listening to your audience. As Jordan Peterson said, when he noted his audience got hushed and silent, well, he knew he was getting through. Part of the reason I do this Discord question and answer is you all are a sample of my audience. You're a selective sample, but you are a sample. And for that reason, I don't know what of my communication is effective without getting feedback from you. And so I have to weigh that, because all of your feedback is weighed through your salience hierarchies. And so, yeah, there's that too, where we've got lots of patterns moving both ways, but just keep working on your craft and pay attention to the feedback and try to listen well and learn from, the Book of Proverbs is full of wisdom here, learn from your critics. Absolutely. Listen to your critics. Listen to the people who hate you. And, you know, when Jesus says, blessed are you when people persecute you, it isn't just sort of this amazing, graceful generosity towards them. There's also wisdom in that, that you will learn from your critics things you will never learn from your adoring fans. And so do all of those things. So there's that answer. I'm going to see who's knocking at my door. I think it's Daniel, but I've got my headphones on, so you can go ahead and ask the next question.
Okay. Next question is from Noct Tempre. What do you believe is the proper path for relationships that have no examples in the Bible? This can apply to Rainbow Coalition if you wish, but I'm thinking about legally broken and or blended families myself. And just to rephrase the question, Noct Tempre is asking a question to the pastor. He's saying, I'm thinking about a non-traditional relationship, or I'm in a non-traditional relationship, and these kinds of non-traditional relationships have no examples in the Bible. So how can I sort of do that in a Christian way, I believe?
There's two truths. There's nothing new under the sun, and human beings are immensely creative. The Bible obviously doesn't have many, many things that we have today. Doesn't have the internet, doesn't have cars, doesn't have nuclear power, doesn't have all through those things. And so what we do is we extrapolate. Now, when it comes to the diversity of family and relationships, the Bible has a pretty broad palette. And so I'd be a little surprised if the non-traditional situation that you speak of doesn't at least have some analogy in the Bible. It might. I mean, surprises for the surprising. So, you know, I can't say that it doesn't. But I've expressed my indebtedness to Jordan Peterson and John Vervaeke. I'll express my indebtedness to Jonathan Peugeot. You know, part of what I have learned from him is the value of hierarchies, the value of center and fringe, the value of things that are in the middle and things that are at the extreme. The Bible has within it how many different ways of family. Look at Jacob, renamed Israel. He marries sisters, something prohibited in the Mosaic law. He has his children with maidservants. Brendan, your mic's a little noisy. I don't know if you can mute. I can mute you for you otherwise if you don't know how to do that. Yet this is the patriarch of Israel. He's the father of the children of Israel. At the same time, I think the center, which is monogamous, the man and the woman and their biological children, sits at the center for a reason. Because I think that is, in terms of human beings, the ideal situation for a family. Now, that isn't necessarily the nuclear family. That can be the extended family. But today, you know, people have lived in all sorts of living situations. And I would imagine that even if you can't find explicit reference to a particular living situation in the Bible, if we were to look at how people in the Bible were living, we might be surprised at how much it doesn't look like Leave It to Beaver. So I think all of these things call for wisdom. And this is part of the reason why in my tradition, the structure of the Heidelberg Catechism, I extrapolate to a good many things of misery, deliverance, gratitude. Christian obedience is finally, I think, an expression. It is certainly what we owe God, but it's an obligation of debt, in that in some ways, and this is how all of our schemes sort of fail us, because Christian obedience is living out of gratitude. This is what we do in response to Christ's great gift. And so we can see that in terms of debt and obligation, that Christ's great gift gives us a debt that we wish to repay, sort of like in Saving Private Ryan, when the Tom Hanks figure, who has, you know, made his way with his little troop all across the Normandy battlefield, finally finds Private Ryan, and Tom Hanks' character has given his life for Private Ryan, and Tom Hanks' character says, "Hey, I gave my life for yours, earn it." And so we see the movie opening with the with Private Ryan, now an old man, coming to the cemetery, finding his Savior's grave and weeping over it, and he wanted to know if he earned it. So in your affairs, in your obedience to Christ, aspire towards that. Now, what this life throws at us often are situations of enormous complexity. Let me use the example of the polygamist who perhaps is converted to certain strains of Protestant Christianity is convicted and begins to believe that his polygamy is a sin. What is he to do with his wives? In a situation like that, I can easily see that someone who believes that polygamy is a sin might carry on in polygamy because of the concern for caring for his wives, who are his dependents in many ways. So he has to balance two areas of obedience. Our lives throw those kinds of things at us all the time. You know, in dealing with the homeless, the desire of the church's neighbors are that the streets be orderly and clean, and there not be drug deals, and there not be all the kinds of things that happen when a homeless population comes into the area. So I've got to weigh that on one hand. On the other hand, I've got to weigh the needs of these other people. And so I try to deal with both of those areas of Christian obedience, stewardship, and gratitude, and often making neither side fully happy. So the agency that God has given you, you know, this is where the Apostle Paul, in, again, his letter to the Corinthians, notes, if you become a Christian, don't just change your marital state. Are you wedded to a non-Christian? Well, this is gets into the question of the of before. Paul says, keep the status in which you were, in which Christ found you, in a sense. Are you a slave? Be a slave. If you get a chance for your freedom, by all means, take it. But becoming a Christian works this way. And so what do you have to do if, let's say, in your devotion to Christ, you come to Him and you come to the realization that there are aspects of your relationship which might not in some ways be God-honoring? Well, join the club. All of us who are monogamously married, even without divorce, have aspects of our relationship that are perhaps not terribly God-honoring. So seek the obedience of Christ in the situation that you're at. And if you've really got a peculiar, non-traditional situation, seek godly counsel of people around you. And, you know, search the scriptures, find clergy and wise persons, Father Zosima, and ask how you should navigate your life. I would suggest that you not make quick turns, because relationships don't take fast transitions well. And whatever non-traditional relationship you're in, the people that you are sharing your life with are just as much your neighbor, to which you deserve, to which you owe love, as the homeless person or a person in a different country. So you're called to love them too. And so as you have to navigate the relationships that you're in, well, figure out how to do that lovingly. And so, and this is why there are some past, and what makes this so hard is that the dual polarities of both a bounded set and a centered set moral gravitation apply. And what that means is, I know that there are pastors who, a couple comes to them, they've been living together as husband and wife without being married. They come to the pastor and say, "Pastor, would you do our wedding for us?" Some pastors will demand that they physically separate and get different apartments before he would consider marrying them. Some pastors ask that they would stop sharing a bed for a period of time, in a sense to refresh the consummation, that they have a period of voluntary celibacy. So in a sense to refresh the consummatorial experience that their marriage as two virgins would have offered them going into this union. Others are just happy to normalize what should have been marriage from the start. And I'm not going to cast condemnation on any of those clergy, because each of us, in whatever situation we find ourselves, must try to do what's right. Sometimes that will mean taking an antithetical, drastic action. And there's value to that sometimes, because it's dramatic, it makes a point, and there's clarity in it. Other times, we ought to be slow and walk a gray path. And it's up to each of us to figure out what love requires of us in each situation. So given the lack of details in your question, which is very much appropriate, depending on how non-traditional this all is, that's the best I can do.
All right. I have a question about Living Stones Online.
Okay.
This is from Postmodern Pilgrim. I think he's kind of new here, but he's certainly welcome. And this is about, he wants people who are involved in Living Stones Online to also get plugged in to the pretty much real-world Christian church community, and he wants them to participate in a real-world worship. And his question reads, should formal membership in Living Stones Online be conditional upon one's participation, or at least commitment to participate in, real flesh and blood community fellowship groups, which would no doubt crop up and could be attended on, say, a bi-weekly or monthly, if the distance is great? Perhaps a caveat could be, if one is already a full participating member of a real-life church, then the stipulation to meet up with other LSO members in real life could be waived. That's the question.
At Living Stones Online and Estuary, I'm continuing to develop. But you might notice that right at the beginning, I didn't use the word membership. I used the word partnership. And the reason for that is I do believe that at a fundamental level, a church online can't really fully be a church. And I noticed Sam had a question about sacraments. An online church can't really fully be a full church. After saying that, I will also say that even real in-person churches fall short of the perfection of the church that God wishes for us. So I, at this point, have not participants or partners of Living Stones Online will not technically be members of Living Stones Christian Reformed Church at 1390 Florin Road. It might be the case that we have made exceptions of membership in Living Stones in the past, extended it to, for example, people in prison. But people in prison, I can go and visit, serve the Lord's Supper to, things like that. So there, I would want, unless there's, again, there's always hard situations, unless there's an extreme situation, I would want at least there to be at some point some physical contact between elements of this body of Christ and a particular body of Christ apart. Part of why I am doing this is because over my last 2 years on the internet, I likened it to this to my local congregation. I said, look, imagine, so we have church here, and let's imagine there's no COVID, and let's say there are 50 or 75 people who gather as members of Living Stones, and they're here in this room. Let's imagine another couple hundred or another couple thousand who silently come into the room, listen to the service, and leave. And no one in the church has greeted them, learned their name, acknowledged their presence, or made any attempt to contact or build community with these people who are silently coming in and silently leaving. In a sense, every time we record a service or stream it on the internet, this is what we're doing. And that's a problem too. And so part of Living Stones Online is the attempt to have these people be known, and also give them an opportunity for them to participate in the church in terms of its financial support and possibly even the church's direction, because I'd like to give the participants of Living Stones Online even an opportunity to shape that ministry. because there are people out there who, for one reason or another, are having a very difficult time participating in a local body of Christ. And the reasons for that are myriad. So, if Living Stones Online can bring Christ's ministry a little bit closer to them, and if Living Stones Online can allow the membership of physical Living Stones to begin to engage this silent, ghostly community that comes in and comes out of our services without our knowledge and make them more real, that seems to me a worthwhile pursuit. But I am continuing to maintain that watching me on the internet is not really participating in the body of Christ. To what degree can we bring the body of Christ closer and closer via the internet? I don't know. That's what I'm going to try. But there still is a line there, and I still recognize that line. And as again with Center and Fringe, I am willing to make exceptions. That would have to be under the guidance of the Living Stones Council. I would imagine that it might be possible in the future to have sort of a Living Stones Online virtual council that has authority over the Living Stones Online portion of the congregation. Some of the people who participate will be members of other local bodies. And for whatever reason, they have in their capacity a willingness and capacity to be members of two churches at once. Now, this is very Protestant of me, because I do believe that every church at a particular address in this world participates in the one Catholic small c church that is traveling through time. And so these are instantiations of that church. And now via the internet, we will try to find the limits of what can happen in that church, but that these are where I'm going to try to go with it. Now, Estuary is going to be, I think, again, an outflow of the church. If you look at Jonathan Peugeot's new icon of the mountain and the wall and the gargoyles and the trees and Leviathan and the sea, you know, when I talk to Jonathan Peugeot at some point, I'm going to say, I want you to put an estuary in that picture of yours, because I think an estuary fits in that, because the estuary is where that flow comes from the mountain out to the sea. And in Jonathan Peugeot's picture, he had sheep and goats that were drinking from the water of the flowing out of the holy mountain. And I think that's right. So estuary, however, is outside the wall. But estuary is part of the grace of God flowing from the church out into the world too. And just as we see God makes the world and gives us life, and some choose to use our freedom and agency in rebellion, and God yet brings the sun and the rain to shine on the just and the unjust. So estuary takes some of that sunshine and rain and feeds the nations with it. But it's in that sense outside the wall, whereas Living Stones Online is sort of in the gate. Okay, and maybe conceptually, that's where these things lay.
Thank you. I've got a question from Sam Adams. He says, how will Living Stones Online serve communion?
Well, it's sort of a continuation of this. Right now, with COVID, this gets complicated in a very Protestant way, because, you know, before Vatican II, the priests were celebrating the Eucharist behind the railing
with their back to the congregation facing the altar, if I'm correct in this. After Vatican II, they turn around. If you go to an Anglican church, I went to Warren Mills Anglican Church, and the very traditional Anglican church, and there at old St. James Cathedral in Melbourne, the Anglican priest served us at the rail. And so, you know, churches have been playing with these things. Living Stones during COVID will continue to celebrate the Lord's Supper. And I recommend that those who are at home in COVID isolation find food and drink to celebrate with us. Those in Living Stones online might do similarly. There is a woman who, she's not a member of my church, but she participates in many things in this church. When COVID started, she told me how she was feeding the Lord's Supper to her two dogs during our services. That would make for a fun theological reflection piece. I did not take offense. I think I understood that in the way that it was offered to me. She's a rather unconventional woman. But she has, see, when I look at Living Stones online and when I look at Estuary, I've been working these things. I think these things are already parts of the church. In every church, there are people who they've agreed to all that, they formally agreed to all the teachings of the church, but they don't know them. And so they stray from them regularly, or they don't even know the ways that they're violating them. But they want to be and are counted as very much inside the church. There's Living Stones online. There are others that say, I understand what you're saying. I can't be part of this church. I don't believe these things. Well, there's space for them in Estuary. I don't believe in the Trinity. Well, there you go. I don't believe in God. Well, there you go. I think the church is full of shit, but I'm a little interested in you, Pastor, and the kind of company you keep. Estuary is for you. This is an estuary, and you are welcome here. And I don't care about your non-traditional relationships. I don't care. I don't care about a whole lot of things in there. If you can, if you are socialized enough to participate in a conversation and respect the others who are there, and begin to see. But that's pretty sneaky of me, and that's pretty colonizing of me, because what I'm already doing is already infecting this estuary with some Christian assumptions about the propriety of loving one's enemies, even if we do so in conversation. And so that's why, in a sense, estuary is an outflowing of the church, even if it's not within its walls. And again, I'm indebted to Jonathan Peugeot, because with his symbolic world and symbolic imagery and his pictures have helped me derive a better understanding of the structure of the church and the structure of the world. And so this dear woman who feeds communion to her dogs, I assume hasn't stopped. And I'm not sure of the value of trying to stop her. Maybe at some point, if she attends a new members class or something like this, and some of the teaching about the Lord's Supper, might have some further thoughts on her celebrating the host with her animals. Then again, in the new heavens and the new earth, if C.S. Lewis's vision of talking animals comes to pass in the new heavens and the new earth, will we celebrate the Eucharist in the new heavens and the new earth? Will we do so with the same way, in the same light in the new heavens and the new earth? I don't know. Will we celebrate them with our animals in the new heavens and the new earth? I was mentioning in the previous question that about the faith of another saving, you know, I get this from the lowering of the paralytic through the roof. What faith did the paralytic express in that? It was the faith of those who lowered him down. So are our pets brought into the new earth through their relationship with us? I think that's a fun idea. I would like to see my dog perfected, because he's quite far from perfection now. I would like to see the sufferings of his inbreeding and all various things in my little dog's life one day redeemed in that little dog. So is there room in God's expansive salvation sweeping net for my little dog? I hope so. That's a fairly non-Protestant idea. I don't find warrant for it in Scripture, and so I am not necessarily going to propose it as church theology, but in terms of hopeful freedom, you know, maybe there is a place for our pets. And in Living Stones Online and Estuary, maybe we will manifest some of the breadth of God's kingdom right here and right now.
Oh, you got me there. That whole communion thing, I think there was a historical example of French peasants feeding the host to their sick cows.
Yeah, yeah.
So much patience is required of us. It's unfair.
Yes.
Ian, you ready? I know you have a question. Ian is here. He has a question about when you share the word of God with other people. Are you there?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm here. I heard I was the last question. Is that true?
Yeah, pretty close to the
moon. Yeah, if you screw it up.
Oh, okay. Well, I can wait for my answer. I'm absorbing so many other things right now. I've lost the interest in my question as before, but I still want the answer, so can wait.
I don't know the question, though.
Okay. What credentials do you think are necessary or appropriate in order to share what you have learned from God?
The Apostle Paul, let me type your question first. The Apostle Paul admonishes us to be always ready to give, to explain the source of our hope in Christ. I don't know what credentials you're looking for beyond the credential that Christ offers you when he makes you his brother and a son of God. That seems a high credential indeed. Now, all of our sharing comes from us and is limited. Some of the most profound sharing of Christ's love and wisdom I see often on the lips of those with that are judged to be low in intelligence in this world, but simple and clear and pure in piety. I think when God makes us his sons. Now, when I say sons, I mean sons and daughters, but sons carries with it in the ancient world the pedigree of patriarchy, let's say, in an offensive way. When God makes us his children, the credential of the prince is being the son of the king. So there's your credential. Now, different communities have the right to expect other credentials, because part of the function of the community is communities can decide who will speak on their behalf. That's the nature of a principality. That's the nature of a community forming into a principality. So you might not have the credential of a community, but if you have the credential of a child of God, what more credential do you need?
That answers my question.
Good.
I did leave some more text of how it could be specified, but that was good enough for me.
Okay.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
I think we have time for a couple more. This one's from B. Palmer. Hi, Paul. Are you familiar with the work of James K.A. Smith? I'm reading his new book on Augustine, and he was interviewed on Rebel Wisdom. And he actually has something to do with Calvin University, and he's talked about Jordan Peterson. And his stuff about cultural liturgies is very relevant, and he wants you to also have a conversation with James K.A. Smith.
I'd be happy to have a conversation with James K. Smith. I've been, and expressed publicly in a number of ways, some of my frustration with him, that I'd love to see him more active in this space. And maybe I should be a little bit more generous with him. Perhaps he doesn't feel called to this space. I don't think he knows this space very well. I don't think he... maybe he does and maybe he doesn't. Many have noted, Julian for one, that in many ways what we're doing in this space is very much like James K. Smith's space. In terms of the places that I have most... both the style of the books he writes and the places he goes, he seems that he prefers sort of the Calvin University-ish, evangelical-ish, progressive-ish, not really full-blown progressive, but moderate, let's say moderate-ish, evangelical and Christian spaces. That's where he seems to want to build his career and put his efforts. His books are pitched towards that. His selection of speaking places seems pitched towards that, kind of the Christian college circuit. And fair enough. That's a legitimate place, and God bless him. I prefer this space. I prefer this space. I'm more of an estuary creature. Sometimes Christian universities and colleges can feel a little too much like a Christian lake. Not a sea, but a lake. Or a pond. And I would far rather swim with Leviathan and play with the creatures of the deep. But he writes great stuff, and I've used a lot of his stuff, the Christian liturgy stuff. It's all good stuff. But my frustration is I want to open up that, I want to take down that dam and maybe at least open the sluice a little bit and let some more of that water flow out, because I think actually the dams that are holding back and creating some of these Christian reservoirs are in fact breaking down, and some of these reservoirs are silting up, and maybe I'm a California environmentalist and I want to see fewer dams, even though here in Sacramento we derive our water supply increasingly from the reservoirs behind these dams. But I want to see the estuaries flourish, and I'd like to see James K. A. Smith take some time out in the estuary. So is he welcome on my channel? Absolutely. I'd love to have conversation with him, because he's a, you know, I'm not an academic. I'm a preacher. And the stuff I get wrong because I'm a preacher. I'm not up to my neck in books all the time, keeping everything straight. I grab an idea, I grab it fast and loose, and I take it out there. And that's part of life in an estuary, more than in a nice, civilized Christian reservoir. And so I want Smith to start playing out here in the deep and take his boat out of the lake. So those are my thoughts.
Okay, I've got another question ready. I think we're close to the end. We have a question from Ben K. And also I asked Jeff P. if he wants to chime in, because he gave me a long question about your video this week. Your video this week, Kristen, or Dr. Kristen Dumez.
Yep.
Her book, In Jesus and John Wayne, which... so you got a choice. You want to tackle Tim Keller or Kristen Cobez Dumez?
Oh, let's take them both. We'll go a little long.
All right.
Did you say you wanted me to ask it?
Please.
Okay. Hey, Paul. This is Jeff. Just wanted to say hi and thank you for everything you do. It's rare that I get a chance to speak with you, so...
So, some on the server would disagree, but go on.
I'm only kidding. I say that in jest. So it's a little bit of a convoluted question, but I listened to your conversation with Dr. Cobes I don't know how to say her
Dume.
Name. Dume. From what I understand, she has a view that America, particularly the American Evangelical Church, loves her heroes and that these heroes aren't necessarily reflective of Christ. It seems like a Christian love of heroes exists in traditions outside of American evangelicalism as well. For example, last night, my wife and I rewatched Return of the King, and a lot of variations of heroes and heroic acts that, you know, run the gamut of what we would consider heroic, or, you know, at least what our culture considers heroic. And I presume that the things that were depicted in the film are pretty close to the versions that Roman Catholic author J.R.R. Tolkien imagined them, because I haven't read the book. So there's the tension that this all raises in me, and it seems like the picture of Christ that we get in the Gospels shows Christ's response to evil and those who were his, quote, enemies, never involved him engaging in violence toward another's person. You know, I'll throw in maybe the caveat of people could consider what he did with the tables in the temple violent. But leaving that aside, like actually causing physical harm to someone else's body. You know, he heals the ear of the servant that Peter cuts off. The only blood he endorsed being spilled was his own. And this is how he, in the Christian tradition, defeated evil, if I'm not mistaken about that. But what I certainly understand to be in the scriptures is that he defeated sin and death in, you know, going to the cross. So all of that is to ask, what, in your opinion, does the Christian hero look like in the face of evil that would do violence to have its way? Since it appears that Christ didn't take up or endorse violence in response to evil, and that's how he apparently defeated it, is the use of violence to fight evil a misread of what followers of Christ should do to ultimately play a part in Christ's victory?
I think in some ways your question gets into the question of pacifism. I am a traditional Christian in the sense that I read the Apostle Paul in Romans 13, understanding that the state is given the power of the sword, and the power of the sword is the power of violence. And in, you know, post-Hobbes Leviathan, the state has a monopoly on the use of power, and state magistrates and emperors and kings and rulers wield that power and delegate that power to soldiers, police, in order to keep order and justice in this violent world. And again, Romans 13 is given at a time when, look at who was on the throne of the Roman Empire. And Peter and Paul had comments about submitting to the government. And actually, sort of because of God number one type stuff, there's actually a lot more going on behind that than most people today think about. You know, John Wayne... John Wayne characters, he was a soldier, you know, maybe a marshal, but each of us would probably also say that there are even extreme examples when violence is not only permitted but necessary for the sake of protecting the weak. I am more at liberty to put myself at risk than I am to put my wife and children at risk. Now my boys are big, and my girls are big too, but we have a duty to protect one another. And so if I'm walking down the street and I see someone beating up someone else, and it seems wise and within my capacity to stop that violence with physicality, I'll do it. I've done it in the past and I'll do it in the future. And so I don't think, part of the reason I did so much biography with my interview with Dr. Dumais was because when I read her book, which after I did the posted it, my mother said, she even put it in the comment section, I'm buying the book. And I could have, if my mother lived closer, I'd say, you can read my copy. Because I knew my mother would like it, because in many ways, Dr. Dumais expresses one subfaction of my own tradition. And our tradition isn't, the CRC is not a pacifist tradition. And so that's not really the issue that she's dealing with. She's much more working through these broader questions of masculinity. And in the Christian Reformed Church in which she was raised, the CRC was undergoing a dramatic, tortured conversation about what women could and couldn't do in the church. Now, in many ways, this question is a very Protestant question. You don't see it working out the same way in the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic. It's because you have priests in that other tradition. Christian Reformed Church doesn't have priests. They have ministers. Now, to some people, that might just sound like two different words, but they're not. A minister, the idea of a minister very much comes out of Luther and his priesthood of all believers. And so do you have women priests after Luther? Absolutely, because all believers are priests and some of those believers are women. But it's a priesthood. So this book comes out of a conflict in a subculture that mirrors the conflict in the larger culture. And in this book, she takes up certain linguistic habits that are obviously present in the larger culture as well. And part of what happened when the CRC opted out of its own pre-Benedict option by lowering the walls after the Second World War was our fights were no longer our own. And so I lament the fact that increasingly fights within churches are just simply smaller versions of the fights outside of churches. Because in the church we have so many more resources to work through these questions that we should actually be doing better at working through them than in the court of public opinion. So I must engage with the fights within my own denomination to a degree. I like playing in an estuary, though, and so I don't want to be too distracted from what I owe my own church home, to not be involved in the estuary, but I need to be involved in what's going on in the pond of the Christian Reformed Church too. And so for that, so next week I'm going to be talking to a friend of mine who works for the social justice organization of the Christian Reformed Church, and I hope to, he already expressed concern that, hey, it's my house, it's my show, it's my audience, and I told him that, Rudy is a friend of mine and I'm going to treat him with love and respect. And I don't even know where we disagree because we haven't gone in. Part of what happens with these kinds of debates is that you stop talking about these things inside the family because you don't want to have a family fight and jeopardize some of the other benefits of community on behalf of this one issue. That's another dynamic that happens in families, and that's why there are elephants in the room sometimes. But the elephants must be treated, and I must deal with things in my own house, my own denominational household. And so part of my channel, I've always wanted to engage in these conversations within my own household, but hopefully use whatever I've learned in the estuary back for the sake of the reservoir. So heroes are, you know, are live in the same universe as archetypes, and everyone has them. Everyone will continue to have them. And John Wayne is an actor, but everybody knows what she means when she uses the name. And my biggest protest of the book is right there in the subtitle, which I asked her about, because how white evangelicals corrupted a faith and fractured a nation. Okay, tell me exactly which faith they corrupted. And tell me about the unity of the nation before this word and this definition of evangelical, which is primarily a media and political definition, came to the fore. So I would have told a different story than she does, but hey, she's a professor in my alma mater, and I'm going to respect her, and she's a lovely person. I got a chance to know her, and that was a sheer delight. She's a daughter of my tradition, and so therefore a sister not only in Christ but in the CRC, and so I will treat her with love and respect, even though we have differences. And if we get the opportunity to go after, to brutally go after ideas while treating each other with utmost respect, kindness, and love, well, I find no better thing to do. And it's that spirit that I'd like reflected not only in the church, but also in whatever estuary I have an opportunity to participate in.
I hear you. You have time for one more question from Tim Keller?
Sure.
All right. This one's a little tough on me. Tim Keller is talking about collective responsibility or corporate responsibility. I think collective responsibility is like when a whole nation becomes guilty of a sin, right?
Yep.
Is corporate responsibility the same thing?
If you understand corporate, you know, corporate is the body, corpus. It's a body. So it's bodily responsibility. And so, for example, if my sons would never do this, my sons are absolute lovely people, but if one of my sons would burn down my neighbor's house, does my son bear primary responsibility for burning down my neighbor's house? Yes. Do I share in some of that responsibility? Possibly, perhaps. That's a far more involved question. Would I, as a father, knowing that perhaps my son does not have the wherewithal to redeem himself, or to somehow restore my neighbor from what my son has done, would I, as a father, wade in and try to make that right, even though if I had known he was burning down my neighbor's house, I would have tried to stop him. As a father, I would step forward and say, because he is my son, I will pay some of his burden. And I think that's corporate responsibility. So, you know, when Douglas Murray in the Madness of Crowds talks about these issues of whether we can blame children for the sin of the parents, well, Douglas Murray has a real point, because we should be really careful blaming children for the sin of the parents. I'm not saying it's a totally worthless idea, but perhaps it's something only God can wield. And the Bible actually talks about this issue, and it's a very complex conversation. You can find pieces of it in Ezekiel. You can find pieces of it in Exodus. So that's an interesting conversation. But is it right for the father of the house to extend responsibility even for what a rebellious son does? Let's say a soldier of the United States Army goes on a rampage and blows up the house of an Afghani family. Is it right that U.S. taxpayers compensate that Afghani family for the house that has been destroyed? I think it is. And so there is such thing as collective responsibility and corporate responsibility. Now, let's also recognize that these things are complex. The law, if my son were over, let's say if my son is 25, let's say if my 25-year-old son burned down the house of a neighbor, the law would not hold me responsible necessarily for that action, and rightly so. But as a father, I could, at this point, voluntarily go to the aggrieved party and say, I do not bless or condone what my son has done to your home. But because I am his father, I will do what I can to make restitution for the act even of my rebellious son. And see, now we're feeling some of the power of Christianity, the power of fatherhood, the power of nobility, where although the father is not legally required to make restitution for his son, the noble father does. Now, the noble father might also decide not to, but that is within the voluntary, that is in the voluntary span of the father. And that's where these questions of, is it that father's responsibility to make up for the sins of the adult son? Maybe not legally. But responsibility is a funny little gray space too, because we all know that our legal responsibility and our moral responsibility do not necessarily fully overlap. We quite rightly keep our legal responsibilities smaller than our moral responsibilities. I think adultery is a sin. I do not think adultery should be a crime. And I think the space between those two worlds is wise. And so, I don't think it's inappropriate. I don't think it would be inappropriate for the United States government to pay, let's use this phrase, pay reparations. But I do think that any reparational type actions should also be done in a way that it does not further harm the descendants of those who suffered from legal, and that's a key thing here, legal slavery in the United States. The constitutional government of the United States continues to stand in legal and, I think, moral history with the constitutional government that enforced legal slavery. And so I think one could argue a legal debt in some ways, but actually doing that with equity, so it not only does not harm the descendants of African Americans, nor does it harm the descendants of those who came long past slavery. And this is where facile, cheap deployment of the word justice is so unjust. Justice itself is a tremendous, large, weighty, complex thing. Do you do justice if in your attempt to restore the harm done to Africans brought over here in legal chains afforded by the American government, you harm another group? Well, that's not justice. You're just shifting it around. And it's that same shift that happened with the slavery. So if you're going to talk about justice, well, have some sobriety about it, because it's justice itself is a weighty thing. And that's why in Christian theology and Christian tradition, justice is a good thing, but justice is a weighty and fearful thing. Because true justice, well, and historically within Christianity, be not so fast to ask for justice, because justice might be required of you. What we pray for so often is mercy and grace, because grace comes and says, I'm going to give you what you don't deserve. What you do deserve is to pay for all that what you have done. The 25-year-old son who burns down his neighbor's house may well not be able to compensate, may not have the resources to pay for everything that that person lost. This, in fact, is part of the advent of slavery. Slavery happened because people could not pay for everything, all the debt that they had acquired. Now, part of what we did against slavery was to, in a sense, rent out human lives. And so what we do now with credit scores and things like that is we say, okay, here's a debt. And if you don't make good on your debt, you're not going to debtor's prison, but you will have a low credit score. And that will, in fact, impact your ability to acquire more debt. And I think that's a tremendous improvement over slavery. And what a wonderful thing that is. And in fact, people like to complain about capitalism. That is a wonderful invention of capitalism because, well, in a sense, I've known many people who have skirted out of life with their debts unpaid. And, well, we don't burn them. We don't enslave their children. We're a wonderfully magnanimous culture that in some ways embodies the grace of forgiveness. And when someone doesn't repay a debt, well, someone else eats that debt. And there was a debt shifting that happened in there. So, you know, justice is a big thing. And in many ways, the son who burns down someone else's house and puts themselves in a debt they cannot repay. Luke 15, the parable of the prodigal son. The younger son cashes out a third of the father's estate, impoverishing the village, goes to the far-off country, lives a life of dissipation, squanders not only the assets of the father, but also the assets of the household, and in terms of the economy, the future of the village. And so the entire village is furious at this young man. The father knows this, and so when the young man comes with Pharaoh's selfish speech to say to the father, I'm not worthy to be called your son. That's right, you're not worthy to be called his son. But the father races out there ahead of the village elders to put the father's cloak around him, protecting him from the village elders, and say, my son cost all of you, I know. My son cost me more, I know. But he is my son, and I will repay his debts because he is my son. And this is the archetype of the good father and of the great king. And Jesus says, this is our God. Now, whose son do you want to be? I want to be his son. The older brother goes out and begins to turn that generosity into entitlement. And the father likewise takes a gentle tone with him and says, my son, everything that I have is yours. Your brother already cashed out his inheritance, and when I die, not only you, but the village will enforce it. But he is yet my son. And what Jesus is saying with that parable is, that person over there, that young foolish son who impoverished the village, and jeopardized your inheritance, he remains your brother. And so when the father extends generosity to him, You ought to recognize the built-in generosity that you have been taking advantage of every single day of your life, which in fact is pure generosity because no one is responsible for their own birth. So there's a little sermon on justice for you. Maybe that's a good way to end.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you for dropping by Discord. This has been a great questions and answers.
I think so, too. I will stop the recording right now and have a few minutes for the post Q&A meeting. So I'd love to, like I said, I depend on your feedback. So I'd love to hear any feedback you guys have, and I'll stop the recording so you can give it just within this room.